The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
What I'd like to do this morning is to talk a little bit about the history of our movement, our Vipassana Insight Meditation movement. And to do it somewhat briefly, with the idea of placing you in it. And where you fit into it, because whether you're new the first time here or whether you've been here for a long time, you've stepped into a current of history, a current of cause and effect that goes back for a long time, has a history behind it. And so it's always the case, wherever you step into, you're stepping into a wider current. And each of you find yourself here. You're here. That's a very profound statement. And here we are. And the here, that where we are, is I think of sometimes as the narrow neck of a like a funnel, or more like a one of those sand glasses. And we have the whole, you know, past, which gets wider and wider as you go back into the past. All the different network of cause and effect that somehow or other comes together here for you into this moment, this very moment. And then from this moment, somehow there's the hourglass spreads out again. Certainly spreads out with infinite potential where it might go. Each of us share at this moment something about this here now in IMC, and we'll spread out here. We'll leave here today and set into motion a cause and effect. Will spread out in many different directions from here. And so here is quite a significant place, and it's sometimes useful to have some appreciation of the background that we bring to here. Certainly there's a background, what I'm talking about today, of Buddhism, the history of Buddhism, but also there's your individual background that you bring. You bring the background of your life experience, you bring the background of your family's experience going back many generations, your cultural experience, your ethnic experience, whatever it might be. And each of us is quite unique in what we bring to this moment here. And so how is it that our uniqueness and the uniqueness that we find ourselves in this moment in Buddhist history come together and to create what goes forth from here as the hourglass opens up again? And it's actually quite wide, what's possible from this moment on. So that's kind of what I had in mind. So I'll try to make it brief, and then I want to hear some things from you. As far as I can tell, Buddhism has always been in dramatic dialogue with the culture that's in, the situation it finds itself in. And it's partly shaped by the culture it's in. And there are a lot of dynamic forces that come into shape that. And the Insight Meditation Movement that we're part of is very much shaped by the culture of our times, but also the cultural and situations of the past, you know, certainly many centuries, but in particular to things that were happening at the end of the 1800s in the 19th century in places like Sri Lanka and Burma, and to a little bit, to some degree, goes that back far in Thailand as well. And you know, it's easy to come to a place, I think it's relatively easy for some people to come to a place like IMC, they're new, think, oh, I'm here to learn about Buddhism. And so there's a teacher who sits up here with a Buddha statue, and which we received from Robert Beattie, who's sitting there. And we can thank you in public the first time. Thank you. It was a gift many years ago. And so it's easy to sit here and think that the person sitting up here, today me, you know, I'm, you know, and you can look up on my resume and see, oh, this guy has some, you know, some credentials. You know, he has a PhD from Stanford. He has this, you know, whatever. He must know what he's talking about. In fact, he must be able to talk about Buddhism. And what he talks about is Buddhism, what the Buddha had to say. And then leave here hearing what I had to say. I heard what this, and now I know what Buddhism is all about. Every Buddhist teacher is offering Buddhism through the filter of their own experience, of their own particular Buddhist tradition they're part of, their culture, And so I don't represent Buddhism with a big B. I represent my particular take, and to some degree also the take of my tradition that I'm part of, the insight meditation tradition, in part of the Theravadan Buddhism tradition of Southeast Asia. And so you always, it's very interesting to begin pulling apart and realizing that it's very hard to get to some idea of a pristine, perfect teaching of Buddhism. There's a lot of causes and effects that go into it. So some people complain about our tradition because it's so Americanized. And, here I am, I'm not even a monk, right? And so how could it, some people think, how could someone who's not a monk be teaching Buddhism? How could a monk not really, you know? And for some Buddhists, that's very strange to have a non-monk offer Buddhism. So we've, you know, here we have a tradition of lay teachers, which is quite unusual in the world, just for one example of how it's changed here in the West. And so we think it's been changed here. But listen to this. So Sri Lanka was an English colony for many centuries. And as an English colony, they were fairly oppressed by the English. And some of the forms of oppression was Buddhism was very much pushed down by the Christian missionaries that came over, a very powerful force in the society in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. And one of the things was Buddhism was discriminated against in its own country. And for example, the Buddhist holidays were prohibited from being celebrated. The Vesak, for example, they couldn't celebrate it. People had to get married in Christian churches. And there's a variety of things. You know, the people's native religion of Buddhism, or somewhat native, couldn't be practiced. And then in 1873, there was a debate with one of the most learned and best Buddhist monks, scholarly monks in Sri Lanka, with a Christian priest. And as it seems to come down to us, that monk bested the priest in the debate. And this was such a big deal for Sri Lanka because they felt so oppressed that it kind of gave birth to a little bit of national pride, but also it became international news. And back in America, I think it was in New York, there were two people who read about this account. And they were Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott, who were the founders, I think, of Theosophy, which was back in those days, there was a whole kind of thing about the occult going on in American society. Ouija boards and, you know, talking to the spirits on the other side. And it was quite elaborate channeling. And Madame Blavatsky was one of the kind of leaders of this occult movement. And she and her colleague, Colonel Olcott, read about this debate and started corresponding with this monk in Sri Lanka. And then in 1880, they went to Sri Lanka. And they did something that for the Ceylonese was very remarkable. On May 25th, 1880, they took the five precepts and took refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And as far as we know in history, in modern history, this is the first time a Westerner took the five precepts and went for refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And this was huge for the Sri Lankans. The fact that the oppressing nation, oppressing kind of, people, the white people, would come to their country and take refuge and do the precepts, as opposed to coming to oppress them further and oppress their religion, was really meaningful for the Sri Lankans. And they celebrated and, treated them as great honored guests. Colonel Olcott went on to champion Buddhism in Sri Lanka. And he became such an important champion. I don't know if it's still happening, but it became a national holiday, Olcott Day, in Sri Lanka, because of the way that he almost helped revive Buddhism in Sri Lanka. He spent about 4 years studying the texts of Buddhism the best he could, and he put together and tried to see Buddhism through its own terms, not through his occult terms that he had. He kind of put all that aside to really study Buddhism. And he wrote a book called, I think it's called The Buddhist Catechism. Is that how it's pronounced? I've only seen it in print, so I don't know how it's pronounced. Catechism. And that became a bestseller back in the 1890s or something and was translated into many languages. And he started schools in Sri Lanka, Buddhist schools. He supported temples. He designed what's now known as the Buddhist flag. Have you ever seen this flag? Multicolored flag. That, you know, we have one upstairs somewhere. That is kind of the best thing we have is a Buddhist flag. He went back to England and petitioned the English government to loosen up on some of these restrictions that the Buddhists were under. Like after, and he won the petition, and then they were able to celebrate the Buddha's birthday again, Enlightenment Day and such things. And he was very important in reestablishing, or not reestablishing, but really kind of reviving Buddhism in Sri Lanka. So when we go to Sri Lanka, for example, to study Buddhism, the pristine ancient tradition of Buddhism, as it was been for thousands and thousands of years, right? Guess, we go back in time, guess who we ran into? A primary influence in this is this occultist from New York City. We can't, you know, we can't get by him. He's right there. Here we have Westerners kind of already beginning to have some big influence on it. And you can't go back to Sri Lanka and not get that influence long before this insight meditation movement was messing with the scene. So then, now Blavatsky and Olcott had there was a Sri Lankan, young Sri Lankan who was about 16 years old, who got really interested in what they were about and also was very interested in Buddhism. And he had been oppressed by his missionary schooling for his interest in Buddhism. In fact, he was caned for, I think, maybe celebrating the Buddha's birthday or something. And so he left that school and just kind of studied on his own for a while and met these two when they came. He was about 16, 17, 18. And he wanted to become a disciple of theirs and wanted to go to, and they were going to make him like the, you know, the Blavatskys were the people who kind of discovered Krishnamurti. You know, some of you know that story. Well, they kind of got excited by this guy and wanted to take him to India and train him. But at some point there was a change, and Madame Blavatsky said, no, don't do this. Don't go and study with the Himalayan channeled masters. You go back, and everything you need is in your Buddhist tradition. Just study that. And so he did. And he became what's called, his name is Anagarika Dharmapala, who became a tremendous force for Buddhism in Sri Lanka by himself and also kind of developed things. And one of the things that he did was he revived the meditation tradition. And meditation had just about died out in Sri Lanka. There were a few people, hermits in the forest and stuff, monks who did it. But it was not really a known tradition. It's certainly not something lay people did. It was monks did, but most monks didn't do it. In fact, there was a belief among many people that it was no longer possible to meditate successfully. And there was a very strange kind of a kind of mystical attitude by people who were in the forest meditating, like they had these strange psychic powers, and there was a lot of awe around them. And so he was interested, and he couldn't really find anybody to teach him to meditate. So he studied meditation through some of the ancient meditation books that still existed. And then from him, his interest then, the interest in meditation began growing and developing Sri Lanka. And now there's a very strong meditation tradition that after now over 100 years, a lot of very developed meditation teachers who have great experience, great understanding of how all this works. But as these people, Olcott and Dharmapala, were developing Buddhism and reviving it, they were very strongly influenced by the Protestant Christianity missionaries that were there. They had to contend with them. So they were kind of reviving a kind of Christianity, a kind of Buddhism that had a kind of Protestant flavor to it. And some of that flavor has to do with one of the aspects of Protestantism is relying much more on direct experience than mediated experience. You know, the direct experience is important rather than the text. Another is much more emphasis on rational dialogue, at least back then, than faith, and much greater emphasis on the laity than on the clergy. And so, in fact, Dharmapala was not an official Buddhist monk. He was a kind of a renunciant who kind of stayed kind of halfway between a monk and a layperson. And so, and Alcott was a layperson. And you found then this development, starting to develop a strong emphasis on lay Buddhism in the way that hadn't been before. And you found in countries like Sri Lanka and Burma the development of the Young Men's Buddhist Association. And, you know, an example of this kind of influence coming from the Protestant kind of or tradition. And so we see this kind of shaping of what's, you know, this selection process of what Buddhism is becoming. Similar things happen in Burma, not quite as dramatic, but in Burma also, meditation tradition had almost died out. And there was a man in the 1870s, I think, named Mingun Jetawan Sayadaw, who was interested in learning to meditate. And he spent a lot of time wandering around Burma, which was hard to do back then, looking for someone to teach him. And he found a monk deep in the forest in a cave someplace, and who was meditating. And he didn't teach him how to meditate. What he said was, you should study and follow the instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So he took that and studied it and started practicing it. And successfully enough that he was able then to teach it to other people. And one of the people he taught was a man named Mahasi Sayadaw, who was responsible for the kind of Buddhism, one of the important lineages of Buddhism that came into the insight meditation tradition in the modern world. And he created one of the most popular forms of meditation Buddhism in Burma. But this Mahasi Sayadaw was also very much influenced by this Protestant rational take. And he was kind of revolutionary in his time in Burma. In fact, there was tremendous conflict or strife or controversy in Burma and Sri Lanka about what he was bringing, because he was such a did away with a lot of the rituals, a lot of the beliefs, a lot of the doctrines, and kind of went back to the Buddha in a very clear, rational way and offered a very particular form of meditation practice. By the time that people like Westerners encountered Mahasi Sayadaw or his disciple Upandita, they were already old people. And they did not appear to us to be these radical firebrands, you know, revolutionary, liberal in their time and place. They looked pretty conservative. you know, conservative, stodgy old guys in some ways. Beautiful, important people. But you know, they, in their own time, they were quite liberal and revolutionary, but partly influenced very much by Western ideas of what's important in religion, rationality. So if you just go to these teachers and study with them, they go, this is what Buddhism is. But there's a lineage behind it. And part of that lineage goes back to the West. You can't really get out of it. It's very much influenced. One of the most important, the best-selling book on Buddhism in English is a book called What the Buddha Taught. It's a beautiful book. Simple, clear, beautiful book by Walpula Rahula, a Sri Lankan man. And many people read that and say, oh, that's what the Buddha taught. Now, he was a great scholar who studied studied Buddhism very deeply. You know where he studied Buddhism most deeply? At the Sorbonne. And there was a great tradition of scholarship in Buddhism in England and France at Sorbonne and in Germany. And a lot of people in Asia went to those places to study. In Japan as well, starting I think in the 1870s, 1880s, a lot of Japanese started going to Europe to study Buddhism, to study Sanskrit, and because the Japanese were surprised to discover that there was all this Buddhism they had no idea about. It was a bit of a shock for them. It was a shock for the Japanese in the late 1800s. It dawned on them, they realized for the first time for many centuries that there had been an historical Buddha. It seems kind of unbelievable to us. But their tradition of Mahayana Buddhism had developed in such a way, they had all these celestial Buddhas that are kind of eternal beings and lived in kind of beautiful celestial Buddhist pure lands. And they had these beautiful, large sutras that described, you know, whole worlds of the very different from our worlds where these Buddhas lived. And the idea that, and they had these tremendous powers, these Buddhas, and the idea that there was an historical person who walked around like us was almost a foreign idea to them. partly because the few references they had to it, it was clearly said that that was not really a human being, but rather a psychic projection of one of these great celestial Buddhas. So this was kind of surprised when this Japanese discovered that there was a historical Buddha. So they started studying this, and where did they study? A lot of what they learned about studying Buddhism came from the West. This is not bad. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily good. It's just kind of what it is there. And I'm saying this because it points to how there's a mutuality and an interactions and a conditional kind of arising of how we understand Buddhism. As we come into the more modern times, our particular tradition of insight meditation was not here in the 1950s. There was little seeds were planted in the West earlier, but not much was going on. And then in early mid-60s, there were these young people who started going to Asia because they were interested in Buddhism. And Joseph Goldstein was interested in philosophy, and from there went to kind of interested in Buddhism. His ticket to Asia was to be in the Peace Corps. And so he went to Thailand. Jack Kornfield was studying to become a doctor, and got interested in philosophy and had a class with a Chinese man who was a philosophy professor, and got turned on to Buddhism. And after a little period of time on the Haight-Ashbury, doing what you do there in 66, Jack Kornfield then went into Peace Corps, and he went to Thailand as well. No, I don't think he went to Thailand. Anyway, what?
He went to Thailand and Joseph went to India.
No, Joseph was in Thailand in the Peace Corps. And so then, anyway, they both went to Peace Corps, and Joseph eventually made it to India and started studying there with the teacher, who was also not a monk, but it was called Anagarika, this halfway between a monk and a lay person, Munindra. And Munindra, so again, this kind of non-clerical, non-monk kind of direction is partly a revival of, I think, kind of influenced by this Protestant idea that let's not go all the way to this monk thing. So if you're getting bored by this, hang in, it's almost over. This history lesson. So we had these young people in the 60s. 60s was an exciting time and a revolutionary time in many ways in our culture. And many of the people who went to Asia were part of this kind of youthful counterculture. Joseph and Jack were older, somewhat, in the mid-20s. Sharon Salzberg was 18 when she went and encountered Buddhism there and meditation. And Christina Feldman, I think, was also 18, wasn't she, when she went there? And so these very young people went there. And they encountered these somewhat revolutionary streams of meditation traditions that were radical in the Buddhist countries themselves. I don't know if they understood how radical they were. They just wanted to meditate. These are the people who are teaching it. But they, very radical, revolutionary Buddhist teachers in their own right. And they studied with them. And one of the features of that was these teachers were very interested in meditation as being a path to liberation. And so they put aside, to a great degree, Buddhist rituals, the emphasis of monasticism, chanting, a lot of superstitious beliefs. And so they got kind of a pared-down form of Buddhism compared to what was going on in the wider Buddhism. And then as they came, when these young people then came to America, back to teach here, they pared it down even more. And there was a conscious decision. Some very interesting conscious decisions were made by Jack and Joseph and Sharon when they started teaching, which was 1974. The first retreats in this tradition were taught in California in the fall of 1974 in the Sequoia National Park And then also within a short time in Boulder Creek, just over the, behind us here in the mountains, close by. And I guess, where did Ruth Denison? She started teaching in 1973, but somewhere around here as well. And so Jack and Joseph made some conscious decisions. And one was not to emphasize the Buddhism part too much, because they felt they had this wonderful practice of meditation that they could teach people, and they didn't want the Buddhism part to turn people off. So they had big discussions about, should we have a Buddha image in the meditation hall? Because that, maybe that'll turn people off to see, have it there. And how much of Buddhism to bring in. And they kind of kept it pretty pared down and simple. They also made some interesting choice to not choose one particular lineage of Buddhism. They had studied in Asia with a lot of different Buddhist teachers and Hindu teachers, and found it very valuable to study with different teachers. And so they did something which I think is pretty unusual in the religious world, where they emphasized pluralism, that they were actually intentionally including different Buddhist teachings and lineages of teachings, traditions, as what they were going to, not necessarily teach themselves, but what they were going to have at their center that they started in the East Coast, Massachusetts. And that's unusual because most people, this is my way or the highway. And you find some Buddhist, these meditation teachers who have that kind of attitude. It's my way, this is the true way, the pure way. And all these other people who teach Vipassana, they don't really teach the pure way. And in fact, some of the teachers in Asia, meditation teachers, excommunicated some of the Westerners for not holding to this straight and true, way. And so Jack and Joseph and Sharon decided to, let's not do this kind of narrow fundamentalist thing. Let's open it up and be a wide container that can incorporate and learn from and respect a wide range of Buddhist traditions. So this ecumenical spirit was there at the very beginning. And then as part of kind of this kind of liberal movement of the counterculture and what followed there, in America at least, there was a strong emphasis that developed with time, wasn't necessarily there right at the beginning, but of egalitarianism, of certainly feminism and gender equality was kind of forced to make them more and more happen. This idea of egalitarianism, we're all kind of like in it together. They didn't like hierarchy so much. And so, so they were lay people and they tried to kind of be a little more equal to their students rather than up on a pedestal too high and, you know, and too different. And there's a lot of other things. So there's kind of these Western currents of interest and certain parts of Western culture then, and values of that Western culture that went into the shaping of the kind of Buddhism that Jack and Joseph and Sharon and Jacqueline Mundell kind of were trying to come up with. And does it represent what Buddhism really is, the essence of Buddhism? Is it a perversion? Is it an adaptation? What is it? Inevitably in Buddhism, down through the centuries, Buddhism always has within it tensions. And there's no Buddhism without tension. Buddhism as a system, as a culture, and one of those tensions is the tension between adaptation and tradition. And how do we play with that tension? There are some people who emphasize the importance of respecting the tradition, but then they think the tradition goes back a long time. But maybe it only goes back, 50 years or 100 years, but still they want to maintain that tradition. And other people say, no, we have to change for the modern times, our situation, and adapt it. And so there's forces to change. And those two forces between people, even inside one person, sometimes are a certain degree of tension about, what do we do? What's the best way? How do we go forward here? And you find, in our insight meditation tradition, that tension is there. Tradition or adaptation, or how should we go? But inevitably, some way or other, our particular condition, our situation, here we are, comes into play with how we're going to interpret and understand and then transmit the Buddhism that we're involved in. And sometimes what we bring in is our own selfish desires. Sometimes we're self-centered, we have particular biases of what we want to be comfortable or safe or whatever. And so we will pick and choose things that go along with our attachments. Sometimes we'll pick and choose that which doesn't reinforce our self-centered attachments, whatever, but that which we feel will most challenge it and help us to free us from ways that we're locked in. How do we ensure ourselves the adaptation process, or even the adhering to the tradition process, really serves for the purpose which Buddhism is meant to be, at least what the early Buddha meant to be. And I think that as I go back, you know, to go back and read the suttas, and even the very attempt to go back to read the suttas is a Protestant thing. You know, go back and read, you know, the Bible. Because mostly for centuries and centuries, Buddhists did not read their own sutras. And some of the things we pick out of the sutras as being so important, you know, I mean, most people who've been around for a while, especially those in the boards and teachers and stuff, know about the Kalama Sutta. The Kalama Sutta was, from any evidence we have, was invisible, was not known, really. For centuries and centuries and centuries in Buddhism, it was discovered and highlighted by these Westerners who really liked the emphasis on don't rely on tradition, but rely on your own ability to discover what the truth is, which is kind of simply what, you know, a simple way what this particular sutra says. So if you go back to the early teachings, the suttas, there's a very simple principle out of which all the rest of Buddhism seems to come out of. And that principle can be said this way. I can say it in a few different ways, but I'll say it. One simple principle is, if you stop causing harm, the harming ends. It's pretty, you know, is that Buddhism? It's like a, you know, it seems like an obvious statement. If you stop causing harm, the harming ends. The harming stops. Another way, if it's a simple principle that's closely related to that, is that if you cling, if you grasp and hold tight, if you cling, you'll suffer. If you let go of that clinging, that suffering stops. A little bit more developed way of saying this, to be more kind of according to the tradition, is in this world we live in, we experience suffering. The cause of that suffering is craving. If you bring that craving to an end, then that suffering ceases. And there's a path, the Eightfold Path, that leads to that cessation, to that ending. This is kind of like the core and simplest principle of Buddhism. And so as we go about adhering to tradition, adapting it, making it fit our lives, our culture, and whatever, then that principle, ideally, would be right at the middle of that effort. We would measure things according to these principles and keep the idea of non-harming at the very heart and center of what Buddhism is about, how not to harm ourselves, how not to harm others. And the experience of liberation is an experience, a radical experience, of the cessation of all doing anything whatsoever that would cause self-harm or harm to others. And that comes with a profound sense of peace, because the lack of peace comes from harm, the causes of harm. And so with that principle, we find our way forward. But here you are, here we are. Each of you is part of this funnel of history that comes into here. Some of you have been entered into Buddhism much more deeply than others. Some of you are really interested in it for your life in some important way. But you, there's a lot of different cause and effect that comes into play in your, you know, as you go forward from here. And as Buddhism comes through you, you're part of the transmitters of Buddhism. And from your particular unique position, for what you have to contribute, who you are, what's important for you and your conditioning, your culture, your situation, how would you like to see Buddhism go forth into the future from you? How would you like to see it change, adapt? What do you contribute? What's important for you in this shaping of it? You're a player too. That's my question for you. rather than say, here, this is what it is. So would anybody like to answer that question? What's unique about you? What is it about you, your cultural background, your ethnic background, your personal background, your situation, that you think has some bearing and importance in this question about how it's going to go forth from here? What do you bring into it? Yes, Carla.
I wish there was more of a worldwide ecumenical sense. When I go to a Chinese restaurant or I talk to my Vietnamese assistant about Buddhism, it's like we're not talking about the same thing at all. I had this delightful Chinese restaurant owner explain to me all the different Buddhist deities and how you have to have some on the lower shelf and some on the upper shelf and what's good luck for this and what's good luck for that. And I didn't recognize that at all.
So you would like, as you go forth from here, you'd like to understand Buddhism or help shape Buddhism in such a way that there's a kind of a ecumenical spirit or movement or some broader understanding that can hold all these differences, maybe.
Yes, I mean, with my Vietnamese assistant, when I mentioned the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, she said, oh yeah, that, I learned that as a child. And then she went into the traditions and superstitions around funerals.
Someone else, thank you. Someone else. Yes, here, Linda.
I guess I don't have an answer for the question, but along those lines, one time when I was in Thailand, a woman came up to me and said, are you a meditator? And I was at a monastery meditating. And so I said, she said, are you a Buddhist? And I said, yeah. we were at a Buddhist monastery. And then she said, you're not just a meditator. And I said, well, I mean, what do you mean by that? I think I'm a Buddhist. And she said, well, all the Westerners here, they like to say they're meditators, but they won't necessarily, they're not necessarily Buddhists. And that is a line that they drew. So I guess I kind of think of a question of the future. Maybe the question of the future is, that difference between what is a Buddhist and what is a meditator? And maybe trying to be Buddhists and not just meditators is an important challenge for Westerners because it can't just be one more thing that we do.
For some Westerners, for some people in the part of Western currents of thinking, the idea of a religious identity, any identity at all, is kind of very awkward for them, and they don't even want to be a Buddhist. They just want to be free or something. So that's part of the struggle. And so you find this hesitancy among some people to say they're Buddhist or to champion Buddhism in any kind of way. And so one of the ways it has played out, has been pointed out in print and places, that there's plenty of people who are lifelong Buddhist practitioners, even teachers of Buddhism, but they're reluctant to teach Buddhism to their children because, you know, that's imposing something, a religion on them, you know, and the kids have to choose for themselves. And yes, Betsy, or...
Well, I was one of those students that Buddhism found. I did not go out seeking Buddhism, so I would have identified with being a meditator and found to my surprise that I was sitting with Buddhists after I had been sitting with the likes of many of you for maybe a month, and it came as a surprise to me that it hadn't been clear from the outset. The tradition that I left behind, I could read that we were to be non-judgers. The tradition I left behind was very clear in the word, thou shalt not judge. And yet my experience was one of being judged, and thus I was quite a judger. And what kept me and what has kept me coming back is that non-ecumenical practice. The tremendous leadership that I have found here, and I can feel my voice getting emotional because it has been an emotional experience. to turn around and face myself every time I see something outside myself, to turn around and face myself, has and will continue to be a lifelong practice that has borne great fruit. And the evidence of peace that I have found here has come from that.
So thank you very much. And so the idea that you come out of some tradition that has some confusion around the whole idea of judgments, and that you found here, perhaps in Buddhism, a kind of more non-judgmental approach, particularly that was reinforced or supported by the ability to look in yourself and see how to free yourself of some of these things that go on, so you could be more at peace or at ease and something like that?
Exactly so. And as I have been asked by various family and community members, are you a Buddhist? I have had hesitancy to say yes, because I didn't want to turn my back on my tradition. I could see in the word of my tradition that the opportunity was there too, but it has been in coming to Buddhism that it has really come to life, in me at least, mm-hmm. and I'll continue to be here as long as that is so.
Thank you. So anybody else want to answer that question? I'm eager to hear some answers to this question. Yes.
I hope I understand your question right, but vipassana means insight,
yes.
Meditation. Insights are realizations, and deep realizations will change your life. They really will. Our path down the Buddhist path is propelled by insights, and the deeper your concentration, the faster the insights come, and the deeper they are. And the last insight is enlightenment. Thank you.
So you didn't answer the question.
What was the question?
The question was, what is it that's particular about you, your cultural, family, ethnic background?
Misunderstood.
That comes in. So maybe we can have one more, because it's time for lunch. So please, open the stage there.
Good morning. I am attempting to answer your question.
Thank you.
And so first I have to repeat your question to make sure that I've understood it. It's what I, based on my cultural experiences, what I can bring, can you repeat your question again?
I don't know if I can. But how does your particular conditioning, your situation, your cultural background or upbringing, how does that help you or support you, or how does it condition you to help shape your Buddhism, or be interested in how Buddhism develops from here through you? And
all right. First, I'd like to respond to the first speaker. I am ethnically Chinese, but was born and raised in Vietnam for the first 8 years of my life, and so I'm very comfortable with the idea of, growing up in Vietnam, I saw many different statues of Buddha, and then in the home, we would have the Kuan Yin. My mother and my aunts would worship the Kuan Yin, and we have the kitchen god, and we have other different statues of deities. So I'm very comfortable with that, and also comfortable seeing my aunt meditating, although I didn't know, and going to temples. And so I had that as a cultural background, and then I came here, and for 30 years I never heard the word Buddhism except in a textbook in English. And then I came to IMC about 6 years ago, and I was like, wow. But being in the United States and living with tension, being bicultural and living with tension, I'm very, very comfortable with tension. And you talked about tension when Westerners take Buddhism, and there's a tension between adaptation of the traditional Buddhist teachings and then adapted to the Western teaching, Western modalities, Western mentality. And I'm also very comfortable with that. I think IMC would not exist if the Buddhist traditional teachings were not adapted to Westerners, Western thinkings, because as Westerners, you have been brought up with the idea of Protestants or Christianities for most of your life, which is a direct contrast of Buddhism. And so in order for IMC and other insight meditations around the country to exist, there needs to be some kind of adaptation of the teaching to so that the practitioners can experience a level of comfort. And when there's a level of comfort and security with the with their practice, that then they can engage in the Buddhist teaching. And it's also helpful that you got your training, your Buddhist understanding from Stanford, because you study this in a formal way. At the same time, you went to Asia and studied from the teachers over there. So I think this melting of different, the Eastern teaching and then the taking it from the Western sensibility, if you will, and continue the practice. And I would like to leave it with one word. I am drawn to teaching to Buddhism, whether we call it Buddhism or meditation, depending on our comfort, is because it has a big component of meditation, but it also has, from what I shared earlier about a month ago about being a child and being taught to be kind, that was and then you said earlier that in the heart of Buddha's teaching is the idea that if we do no harm, then harm would cease to exist. And that is basically what was instilled and conditioned and cultured within me, and that's what continues to draw me to Buddhism and to the practice of meditation, to reach at that point where I do no harm, so that suffering could stop.
Beautiful. So beautiful. Very well said. And so those of you who come to IMC are seeing a particular way that this whole Buddhism stuff has come together here at this particular time, this particular place, these particular people, you included, and it'll change and develop from here. And we had all these wonderful guests from all over the country who are also doing similar things. We have enough in common. That's why we're getting together. But also, I'm very excited to see how this particular tradition doesn't stay the same as we have it in IMC, but rather, it'd be wonderful to replicate IMC a few other places maybe, but I'd love to see people have the creativity and the courage and the wisdom to find all kinds of different ways of presenting this tradition, this insight meditation, this freedom, this compassion, in new ways. And one of the things I hope that we can foster is support for the people, for anybody who has other ways of, other cultural ways or ways of letting this thing develop. I mean, for example, one small thing. You know, I'm not musical, whatever. And so you get this kind of like white Protestant kind of musicless kind of Buddhism for me. But if I'd been a musician, you know, like I bet you sing, don't you, Robert? Robert Beattie is a Dharma teacher in Portland. And do you ever sing as part of your Dharma talks?
We sing and we dance.
And yes, can you believe that? Can you believe it? You know, so you're not going to get that here, but I love it. I love it that they do that up there. And so
you know,
yeah, moving to Portland. So we'll end for the potluck, and perhaps would you be willing, Robert, to do the same song?
Oh, I'd be delighted.
So yesterday for the lunch here, Robert led us through kind of a blessing song, beautiful short thing. And so why don't we set up for our potluck, and apologize that we ran late. But if you're new here today, please stay for the potluck, and you know, people are friendly, and introduce yourself. Thank you.